get back to your seats and we'll transition into our teaching time. I was just speaking with Brad. Brad is officiating the wedding of Brad and Bailey in Vancouver, so he's taking off. And also speaking with Derek Rogeski, our moderator on our elders team, and he has to leave early as well. So thankfully they both moved from the front row so that in the middle of my message they don't stand up and leave. And hopefully that doesn't signal some sort of disagreement with what we're going to be listening to. So they assured me that it's not theological in nature, it's just the fact that they have some scheduling conflicts at the moment. So if there are people changing seats a little bit, hopefully there's nothing to be alarmed on. But this morning, we're going to continue in our series that's looking at the family. We've called it Family Portraits. We've looked at marriage once or twice. We've looked at handling conflict in marriage. We've looked at just last week, Bob and Penny Armstrong, from the Willows. They looked at different personalities and just the different issues that you have from being a man and being a woman and having different perspectives in marriage. And we're going to talk about parenting in a couple of weeks. But today we're going to talk about singleness. And I was thinking about this a couple weeks ago, that I remembered that when I was a student at Trinity Western, I was involved in a small group with several men. We were about 21, 22 years old, and it was a discipleship group. And we took one of those spiritual assessment tests. And I'm sure many of you have taken those. It goes through a number of questions, and you basically reply with how strongly or you agree or disagree, and then at the end you tally it up and it tells you what sort of gifts you have. You have the gift of administration or of teaching or evangelism or singleness or whatever the case may be. So we were pretty excited about this, and you know, we did all this, and hey, we're going to go conquer the world for Jesus. Let's look at our test results. And one of my buddies laughed a little bit as he was looking at his results, and he says, I scored pretty high in celibacy. And we're like, all right, like, we're all single, right? No one's married here. No one's really even dating anyone, and we're all pretty young, so not really a big surprise at all. But then he says, I actually scored higher in celibacy than I did in faith. And we're like, interesting. That's a bit more perplexing. And so we started to think about this a little bit, and I realized now that at that age, looking at different gifts and even trying to understand what gifts were, what's the difference between a gift and a spiritual gift, what does Scripture teach about that, we hadn't really given that a whole lot of thought. And we hadn't really thought about, too, that God gives us gifts in particular times in our lives and other times for the duration of our life for a purpose, to build up the church and to reach people who need Christ. And so I emailed my friend just earlier this week, and I said, hey, Jeff, do you remember this story? And he said, I've forgotten the story, but he said, quote, I'm still very gifted in that area. And he also said, which I found very intriguing, he said, and on a certain level, it seems a little bit easier than faith. So this morning, we're going to look at singleness. We're going to look at how this family dynamic has an incredible impact on our church and on our community. And several months ago, when Brad and I were scheduling this series, we were thinking about, you know, different topics and things to address as we talked about the family, immediately both of us said, we definitely want to speak on singleness. Because singles, couples, children, all of us are part of families, and we want to affirm that, and we want to understand how each of us has different gifts during those different phases of life and during that journey of time that we have. And so the text that we're going to look at this morning to frame our understanding of marital dynamics is 1 Corinthians 7. And we don't have a whole lot of time to look at the specific context of this chapter, so I'm going to give you a bit of an abbreviated summary about what Paul has been talking about leading up to these verses. Paul specifically talks about marital relationships in 1 Corinthians 7. And so in the first 16 verses or so, he says to those people who are married or who used to be married, he basically tells them, stay as you are. Don't seek to leave your spouse, and don't seek to get married. And then in the immediate context of the verses that we're going to look at this morning, Paul's guiding principle to his readers is once again to stay as they are to those who are unmarried at this point in time. But in verses 25 through 35, which we're just about to read, Paul gives us his rationale for why people should remain in their current marital status. And so as I read this text, and as you follow along in your Bibles or on your screens, pay attention to some of these reasons why. And I'll be reading from the New Living Translation, which Brad has been influencing me to use. So I've got a piece of paper here this morning. 1 Corinthians 7, 25 through 35. Now regarding your question about the young women who are not yet married, I do not have a command from the Lord for them. But the Lord in his mercy has given me wisdom that can be trusted. And I will share it with you. Because of the present crisis, I think it is best to remain as you are. If you have a wife, do not seek to end the marriage. If you do not have a wife, do not seek to get married. But if you do get married, it is not a sin. And if a young woman gets married, it is not a sin. However, those who get married at this time will have troubles. And I am trying to spare you of those problems. But let me say this, dear brothers and sisters, the time that remains is very short. So from now on, those with wives should not focus only on their marriage. Those who weep or who rejoice or who buy things should not be absorbed by their weeping or their joy or their possessions. And those who use the things of the world should not become attached to them, for this world as we know it will soon pass away. I want you to be free from the concerns of this life. An unmarried man can spend his time doing the Lord's work and thinking how to please him. But a married man has to think about his earthly responsibilities and how to please his wife. His interests are divided. In the same way, a woman who is no longer married or has never been married can be devoted to the Lord and holy in body and in spirit. But a married woman has to think about her earthly responsibilities and how to please her husband. I am saying this for your benefit, not to place restrictions on you. I want you to do whatever will help you serve the Lord best with as few distractions as possible. Well, there's several words and phrases in this passage that need a bit of unpacking if we're going to fully understand it. And the first phrase that needs some attention is in verse 26, where Paul talks about the present crisis, this impending crisis that is facing these people. And based upon the historical situation of Corinth at this time, it isn't likely that Paul's speaking about some sort of natural disaster. During this time period, there wasn't a famine, there wasn't an earthquake, there was relative peace there, and so it doesn't seem like he's talking about, hey, because this terrible earthquake happened, you shouldn't get married, and you should just kind of stay as you are while we sort of settle how things are going to happen. And it's much more probable that what Paul's talking about when he talks about this present crisis is the anticipation of Christ's return to earth. And we see that in the context of the passage. We see in verses 29 to 31 that Paul talks about the temporary state of things and whatever they're doing, the things that they're doing in this world and these responsibilities, they pale in comparison with this crisis that's happening. The time is short and the world is going to pass away. And so it makes sense that we look at present crisis as a reference for the second coming. And this was very much in the mindset of first century followers of Christ. When Christ said that he was going to return shortly, they literally thought it was shortly. And so it's that frame of reference of saying, don't get too caught up in what you're doing here in the world, because we have a relationship with Christ and we're expecting him to come back right away. And the second group of words that we need to look at are the words trouble and problems that are found in verse 28. Paul explains that people who get married, they're going to have troubles, and he's trying to spare them from these problems. Now, if I were funny, this would be the perfect spot to put in a marital joke, right? But after thinking about it all week long, I've got nothing. So I apologize about that. I'm sure everyone here has probably got a good punchline in the back of their minds, but I'm just going to restrain myself, and I'm going to have a good week of marriage with my wife because of that. But I think it's important that when Paul looks at troubles and problems, we understand that Paul was not a marriage counselor. He was not talking about all these challenges that you're going to have if you get married that you may not have if you don't get married. Again, he's referring to the distractions that marriage can bring, and we see that later on in these verses. So we should understand the troubles and problems that Paul speaks about in verse 28 as the divided interests that Paul teaches on later on in verse 34. So this whole section together explains that married individuals have responsibilities in their home that they need to attend to, and this can limit their capacity to fully serve God in every area of their life. But here's the key, and this is the central principle in this chapter that hopefully comes across and hopefully you can take away with you this morning. Paul tells the Corinthians to do whatever they can to serve God best. He does not instruct them to get married, and he doesn't completely tell them that they need to remain single. He suggests that singleness is perhaps more advantageous than being married, that has some benefits for ministry, but he doesn't outrightly command it. And so the key is doing what you can to best serve the Lord. And for some, serving God might involve marriage. I know of many people, gifted people, when they get married together, it seems like their ministry booms. And the gifts that they have together, they just really complement each other well, and God uses that, and there's great things that come through that. There's also some of the gifts of mutual encouragement and prayer support for each other. But Paul clearly affirms in this passage that singleness is actually an even better option for serving God. And this is a pretty drastic opinion that Paul holds. If we look at the context of the Jewish life and look at some texts in the Old Testament, we see that the pendulum is shifting quite a bit from what these people would used to be hearing. Because the Jewish concept of marriage was very clearly defined. You got married and you had kids. It's pretty much end of story. This was the overwhelming scenario. Marriage was expected. In fact, there is no word for bachelor in biblical Hebrew. Marriage was simply a given. And so there's a couple of reasons for this Jewish expectation of marriage that are worth looking at, and they're theological in nature. So the first is that the picture of marriage that's used by God and by the writers of the Old Testament is a metaphor for God's covenant with his people. And so God uses people's understanding of marriage, the relationship with their spouse in the Old Testament, and he relates his covenantal relationship with them to help them personally relate to it. So God's original calling and promise to Abraham called for descendants. And you have to have kids to have descendants. And you have to have a spouse to have descendants. And for Abraham, he even took more than one just to make sure he got it right. And even more significantly than that, the promised Messiah, who's going to bring victory to the Jewish people and reconciliation, he would be known through the lineage of David. Yet again, marriage, children, and descendants. And so marriage and children were the means by which God fulfilled his promise to his people. And so you can see how this Jewish mindset is, well, obviously I'm going to be married and have children. This is just the way that the world works. And the second concept that's a bit interesting in the Old Testament times is that Jews had a very limited understanding of the afterlife, much different than our contemporary understanding and belief in life after death. In the book of Job, Job compares a dead man to a cloud that vanishes and passes away. It's pretty bleak. But this was the common thought. Life after death? Not quite sure what that looks like. It seems like it's the end of existence. And the means by which people pass their legacy on was through their children. And that's why I have such an emphasis in the Old Testament on heirs. You have the eldest son who carries on the family name, and as a man and his wife, as they die, well, the children carry on that family name and their heritage. And this is why, for the Hebrew, nothing is worse than the extermination of the family name through failure to bear children. And so marriage and family are so important to the Jewish people in the Old Testament that personhood is understood through the physical family. There's this direct linkage between personal identity and the biological blood family that they have. But in the New Testament, we see that the role of the family changes. And as Jesus commonly does with perceptions that the Jewish people had. He challenges their belief systems, the ways that they've kind of gone astray and just done habitually for a number of years. And so we see that the common metaphor for the new covenant that Christ institutes is actually a metaphor of adoption. We see that there's this image of chosenness, of Christ gathering people to him and of people individually responding to Christ and entering into a covenant of faith. And the role then of the church, the collective amount of people here, all the individuals together, their role is to carry out the mission of Christ. The church is no longer a physical blood family. It is a family of faith united through the blood of Christ. And so the metaphor and the meaning of family, it shifts a little bit in the New Testament. And secondly, the understanding of the afterlife greatly changes. Christ taught about eternal life, and then his act of the physical resurrection made it possible for all to continue living after death to those who believe. And so there's no longer this fear of dying for those who have no heir. Their inheritance is life eternal with God, and they are then remembered by the church, by the body of the faith, the spiritual family. And so we have this shift of thinking from the Old Testament to the New, that the physical family comes second to the spiritual family. And this is why Paul offers practical advice for those who are single in this impending crisis. Do what's best for you. Do what you gotta do to serve the Lord best. And for Paul, there are certainly benefits to being single. And we'll look at these right now. The first, the major advantage that is quite evident in this passage is that it provides individuals with less distractions and more freedoms to serve God. Singles can be more fully devoted to use their gifts to impact the kingdom. They don't have some of the other responsibilities that married people do in a family context. And this is quite an advantage. I was thinking earlier this week, I was thinking about the singles here at our church at Jericho. And I was kind of going through them in my mind, and I was thinking about all the different areas that they're plugged into our church, the different ways that they serve, the amount of effort that they put in to help around here at the church. And I thanked God for singles. And I imagined for a moment what our church would look like here at Jericho if we had no singles. And it was a pretty scary thought, because the singles here in our church are doing so much for building up the body here at Jericho Ridge. We would not be the church that we are if it were not for the ministry of our singles. And another advantage of being single is the incredible testimony that it provides. And this is going to take a bit of explanation. As followers of Christ, we're called to be his witnesses. We all have that calling in the book of Acts. But I think that singles have a very unique calling in this sense. In the Old Testament, as we just spoke on, the Hebrews looked at personal wholeness and fulfillment. They looked at this being done through the family. And marriage and family were needed for them to feel complete. But in our culture, this is really no longer the case. Singleness is affirmed as much as marriage is. And according to secular culture, singleness certainly has its benefits over being married. But Rodney Clapp, in his book, he suggests that our society treats sex as the ultimate expression of personal wholeness. Sex becomes number one now. Maybe for the Jews, marriage and children were number one, and now it's just the physical act of sexuality that has trumped it. And it definitely does not need to be confined to a marital relationship in this day and age. But Christian singles send a very strong message to our world by living lives of fulfillment, living lives of wholeness without being married and without being sexually active. And this is a powerful testimony of personhood when you think about it, that singles, adult singles, are able to interact with other people and say, yes, I am fulfilled, actually. I am not in need of anything else. Their individuality and their singleness is made complete through the power of Christ. But singleness also has its fair share of challenges. And before I begin describing some of the challenges of being single, I have to put in my own disclaimer that I was not a single adult for very long, so these are some of my observations. This is a good text to teach on, because this is the chapter where Paul talks about saying, well, this isn't a direct word from the Lord, but I feel that this is probably pretty close to the mark, so I'll use that as well for myself this morning. But I have looked at a few books, and I've spoken with some singles here at Jericho, and in my mind, this makes sense for some of the challenges that singles have. And I'm going to begin with a statement that may sound a bit blunt, and may even be a bit offensive to some of us, but it's just an observation that I've been thinking about. In my opinion, the overwhelming majority of challenges that singles have, I believe that they're the result of the pressures that married people often put on singles. I think that many times those who are single, they take their own expectations of those who are married, place their expectations on singles and make them feel as if they are less than adequate. And these questions and these comments and these expectations can take a toll on their lives. They can damage their self-identity. I'm going to give a few examples of this, and the first way that this happens is through awkward questions and comments. I spoke with an individual earlier this week that told me that a common introductory question that she receives is, any guys in your life? And another person told me that they are asked more about their potential love life than about their spiritual life. And she told me, I just wish it was the other way around. And when we use these sorts of questions and comments on a consistent basis, I think it has the potential to make singles wonder if something's wrong with them. Do I need to be fixed? Is my life unfulfilled because I am not married? And another challenge that comes from time to time is depersonalization. Broad assumptions are often made of singles. Labels are attached to them as if there's something wrong with them, as if they're carrying some sort of disease of some sorts. I wonder what's wrong with that guy. Like, he's smart, but he's still single. And I think sometimes we look at singles this way and we put them in the singles box, not quite sure what to do with them, and just hoping that they get married without maybe thinking, you know what, maybe this is a gift for them to use, and maybe they're completely satisfied with their own singleness. And we depersonalize many other groups of people as well, too. We do the same thing with those who are married. We do the same thing with those who do not share the same skin color as ours or who have a different sexual orientation that we do. And we're turned off by that a little bit. We're not sure what to do. So we maybe ask a few odd questions, and we depersonalize them in some sense or another. And the third challenge that I want to suggest here is that a lot of times single people simply feel lonely. I was speaking with a friend the other day, and she told me, quite humorously, but I think there's a bit of truth to this, that today we should have sponsor singles. And just like we have sponsor children overseas, you get your picture of your Jericho Ridge single, you've got their name there, you take it home with you. But overseas, you know, you write them letters and you pray for them. But here in the church context, well, you invite them over for dinner. Come on over. Have some dinner. And she even told me that it would pay dividends later on because it'd be babysitting years to come. You know, you invest in the single and there's a little bit of a payback there. But a little bit more seriously, I think this is an issue that sometimes singles feel forgotten. They feel like they may not always fit in, and there is the loneliness factor. Another friend of mine recently told me, she said, I wish that people would just invite me over for dinner more often because I'm single and I live alone. And if someone doesn't invite me over for dinner, I will eat by myself, just like I did last night and every other night before someone else invited me over for dinner. And this is sad. And it's not just sad that singles feel forgotten or perhaps marginalized or lonely or insulted. It's sad that at times they don't feel like they have a family, especially when they're connected to the family of faith that should be our priority, should be the priority over our families of blood. And so my challenge for us this morning is to consider our spiritual families. How are you taking care of the people who you're sitting around right now? Have you invested in their lives? Do you see this corporate body as your priority, as the family that you take care of, as brothers and sisters in Christ. And so we're going to move into our time of application and response, and I have a few questions that I'd like you to consider. And I mentioned several challenges that singles face, and I suggest that some of them may even exist because of the beliefs and behaviors of some people who are married. So my request for all of us is that we would have a healthy understanding of the family, one that places the church family first. When Jesus was told that his mother and his brothers were outside waiting to speak with him while he was teaching one day, Jesus said, Who is my mother and who are my brothers? And he looked at his followers, his family of faith, and he said, this is my family. And this is not instruction to abandon your physical families, to just ignore your kids who are toddlers and hang out with some of the single folk here at Jericho Ridge. But it's an emphasis to understand that we have an obligation and we have a tie to our brothers and sisters of faith, regardless of their marital standing, regardless of their age. This is our family right here among us. And so if we aspire to be a family of faith, then I think we need to consider our message. That's our first application. We need to recognize that our language and our assumptions, they announce our values. When we make comments, regardless of who they are and in what nature they are, people are analyzing those. If someone says, you know, well, have you been out on a date lately, or when's the last time you had a serious relationship, that just elevates the value of being married that much more. So as we discussed, that's, you know, somewhat problematic, and that can help or that can hurt someone in their own self-identity and their connection and their faith. So how do our values compare with God's values? When we say things like that, what does that say about our values? And secondly, I think that we must be a family. In a society where families are lost and dysfunctional and unaware and non-committal, what greater witness to God's incredible love than to not only represent, but to act as God's family? To adopt people. People who are widows, divorced, married, single, engaged. The spiritual family is given priority. And the family grows evangelistically, not biologically. Our family here at Jericho grows, well, it does grow biologically as well, as we've seen over the last year or so. But the mission of the church is to draw people in, to have people be adopted and grafted into our family for the glory of God. And third, we must affirm the gifts of our family. Singleness definitely is a gift, even if it is a gift only for a certain amount of our time. For some of us, that might be 3 years in our adult lives. For others, it might be 15, and for others, it might be the duration of their adult life. But singleness definitely is a gift. And it's a gift here at Jericho that I think we need to affirm, and we need to applaud in the life of our singles. So this morning, as an act of celebration and as something we do as a spiritual family, we're going to share communion together. And communion is centered upon remembrance. It's centered upon remembering that our personhood is defined by the sacrifice and victory of Christ. It's not defined by our friends. It's not defined by a spouse, perhaps. It's defined by the victory of Jesus Christ and our allegiance to Him. We remember that we are all lost, and we are once orphaned from God, but by confessing our sins, by accepting His grace, we are now adopted into the family of faith. So Aaron and the band are going to come. They're going to share a song, and I would encourage you as they sing this song and lead you in this song to examine your lives and to think about the family of faith and to consider the words that you've used and the values that you have and what that means for those around us. But we're going to do communion a little bit different this morning. We have two tables set up like we typically do, or one over there on your right and another over here on your left. And this morning, to symbolize that we are all one family of faith, we're going to take communion together. So I encourage you, as this song is played, to spend some time in confession and prayer, and then to grab the juice and the bread and come back to your seats. And after the song is sung, we are going to take together, and then we're going to end on a song of celebration. So let's do that at this time. Thank you.